Welcome back to Never Found, Never Forgotten. I'm your host, Melanie, and today I'm going to tell you about an epidemic of missing Native American women that affects hundreds of families every year here in the United States. I'm going to share just a few of the many, many, many cases. This is something that I started to research. I was looking into one case, and then I learned that there were so many more. I learned about the missing and murdered Indigenous women's movement across the United States and Canada. And this project just became so much larger. Years of systemic racism and bureaucracy have created barriers to reporting women missing, searching for women after they go missing, and getting their stories into the media. Reforms are beginning to take place and different laws are being passed to help address these issues. But until then, we must tell their stories. We must say their names. And today I'm going to share the disappearances of Alyssa McLemore, Ashley Loring Heavyrunner, Janice Hannigan, Rosalita Longhi, Tanya Begay, and Jermaine Charlo. The commonality between these women is that they're all Native American, and they're all missing. I'm going to start the episode with the case that started this all off for me, and that's the disappearance of 21-year-old Alyssa McLemore. Alyssa disappeared from Kent, Washington on April 9th, 2009. Alyssa apparently called 911 and asked for help around 9:15 or 9:30 that night. But then the line went dead. Apparently there was no GPS sensor on her phone, so the 911 dispatchers were unable to find the location of the phone call. At that time, Alyssa lived with her grandmother and her mother, who was suffering from scleroderma. And scleroderma is a rare autoimmune disorder that typically affects women between the ages of 30 and 50. Alyssa also had a 3-year-old daughter. So on the night that Alyssa went missing, her grandmother called to tell her that her mom's health was worsening. Alyssa said she would be right home. Time passed and Alyssa did not arrive home. But police later arrive to the house and they ask about Alyssa's whereabouts because they had received this 911 call asking for help. But then the line went dead. So it seems they were able to trace the phone number to Alyssa, but not the location of the phone. Alyssa was an adult and free to come and go, so the police don't really do anything. They can't really do anything. And a missing persons report was filed 40 years later after Alyssa disappeared. What is especially heart-wrenching about this case is that Alyssa's mom passed away 3 days after her disappearance. And I can't even imagine what this family was going through dealing with the death of Alyssa's mom and having this missing daughter at the same time. A witness reported that they had seen Alyssa in an area of town that is known for prostitution, and Alyssa had previously been arrested for prostitution. The witness saw a green pickup truck approach Alyssa. The truck possibly had Oregon license plates, and the witness also described her being with a Caucasian male in his 50s or 60s, about 5'8" and weighing 185 pounds, also with a green pickup truck. At this point, police don't know if this man is involved in the disappearance, but he seems to be the last person who was seen with Alyssa. Like I said, Alyssa was the mother of a 3-year-old daughter, and family says that she was devoted to her daughter. She would never just leave. And she was also super close with her mom, and her mom was in ill health, so it seems really unlikely that she would not be there for her mom. When Alyssa first went missing, her race was described as Asian. Alyssa was actually part Aleut, an African American. And this happens often in cases of missing Native American women where their race is misidentified. And this can just prolong the identification process and the search process. The next story is that of Ashley Loring Heavy Runner. Ashley was 20 years old on June 5th, 2017 when she disappeared. Ashley left her family's ranch near Browning, Montana to attend a party. Ashley texted her sister Kimberly while at this party to ask for some money, but her sister was in Morocco on vacation. So her sister was like, "Can't, I'm in Africa. I'll text you when I get back." Ashley and Kimberly were planning on moving in together. They were planning on getting an apartment in Missoula when Kimberly returned from her trip. And Ashley was really looking forward to this change of pace. Browning is a smaller town, a ranch town. So she was looking forward to moving into a larger town with more things to do. And the sisters were very close. And they were looking forward to sharing an apartment together. A few days after this party, Kimberly does return home from her trip, and she didn't hear from Ashley right away, but she didn't get too concerned because Ashley was known to often lose her phone, and so Kimberly didn't think too much of it. But in mid-June, Kimberly and Ashley's father was suddenly hospitalized with liver failure. Unable to reach Ashley, Kimberly was checking with other family members and friends, and she realized that no one had heard from Ashley since the night of June 5th. Kimberly reported Ashley missing to the Blackfeet Reservation Tribal Police, as well as the federal agents from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA. Unfortunately, again, because Ashley was 20 years old, Kimberly was told that she was an adult and could come and go as she pleased. There were several leads that sort of turned up nothing at first. One witness said that she saw a woman running from a vehicle along a desolate stretch of road. A search of that area turned up no clues. Another search found a gray sweater that was believed to be Ashley's, but the sweater was later misplaced by investigators before it could even be tested. Frustrated, Kimberly became active in the missing and murdered Indigenous women's movement. She actually testified before Congress in support of Savannah's Act, a federal bill that would improve data collection related to crimes against Native American women and streamline communication between agencies. This bill is named after a woman named Savannah LaFontaine Graywind, who was a 22-year-old member of the Spirit Lake tribe who was found murdered when she was 8 months pregnant. The baby had been cut from her body by a white neighbor. While Native American women make up just 3% of the state of Montana's population, they make up 30% of all missing persons cases. The FBI took over Ashley's case after several leads took the investigation off the reservation. The gray sweater was found and is being tested. Ashley was a student at Blackfeet Community College, and her family describes her as intelligent and outgoing. The next case is that of 16-year-old Janice Hannigan. On Christmas Eve, 1971, 16-year-old Janice Hannigan was discharged from an unknown hospital near Waputo, Washington. She had been admitted to the hospital on December 21st with bruises to her head and to her chest. The surviving medical records do not tell the cause of these injuries. Janice left the hospital and was never seen or heard from again. Janice was the oldest of seven children. Her parents separated when she was just 8 years old. The younger six siblings remained with her mother, and Janice chose to live with her father. In 1971, she was a sophomore at White Swan High School, and she was a candidate for the Queen of Intertribal Veterans Day Ceremonial. And this was an event in which the candidates sold tickets to a fundraising type event, and whoever sold the most tickets was named Queen. The Queen would wear a new beadwork crown with a special insignia honoring veterans. Janice and her fellow candidates were featured in a newspaper article in full regalia, and the article listed her hobbies as cooking, beadwork, and watching football. Today, Janice's parents are both deceased. Her sister, Trudy Lee Clark, who was just 8 years old when her sister went missing, is left with more questions than answers. With inconsistent records and reporting, Trudy is frustrated. Trudy has a file containing old information and records that have incomplete and inaccurate information. One flyer lists the date Janice went missing as March 1st, 1971, and that she was deceased on that same date. One national website lists her as a runaway, but Trudy doesn't believe that she would have run away. There was no reason for her to run away. According to a Bureau of Indian Affairs missing persons report from 1975, Janice had gone with her dad to a basketball game in Lewiston, Idaho in February of 1971 and went missing from that game. Trudy expresses her frustration that local, state, and federal databases don't talk to each other. Also, local, state, and federal agencies don't communicate with each other. Trudy has submitted her DNA to the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System database, also called NAMIS, to help with possible identification should remains be found so that information can be compared. Until then, Trudy continues to campaign for answers. The next case is also from Waputo, Washington, and that is the disappearance of 18-year-old Rosalita Longhi. Rosalita was last seen at 10 p.m. on June 30th, 2015 at her grandmother's house in Waputo. Rosalita had been raised by her grandmother after her mother voluntarily signed over custody when Rosalita was just 2 years old. Her grandmother, Verlyn, describes Rosalita as helpful at home, but she was somewhat of a rebellious teenager. Eventually, she fell into a bad group of friends, and she started using drugs and dropped out of school. But it seemed like she was trying to get back on track. She was trying to get her GED. Verlyn said that Rosalita had started staying with her boyfriend, Isaiah Andrews, but she could come and go at home as long as she was not drinking or high. Verlyn also had Rosalita's younger sister and a younger cousin at home, so she didn't want the kids around that sort of behavior. On June 5th, Rosalita showed up and was under the influence, so Verlyn asked her to leave. Later, around 10 p.m., Verlyn heard a knock at the door and she asked who it was, and it was Rose. Verlyn told her to, quote, go away, end quote, and that's something she regrets very deeply. That was the last time she heard from her granddaughter. In July 2017, Isaiah Andrews was shot and killed in a violent homicide. Verlyn believes he was killed because he knew what happened to Rosalita and was killed in order to keep him quiet. Kimberly, Rosalita's mom, has also submitted her DNA to the NAMIS database for comparison. Another case is that of Tanya Begay, a 36-year-old woman. She was making her way from Leop, Arizona to her family's home in Gallup, New Mexico. Tanya was traveling with her boyfriend, Jason Thornburg, and the two stopped at Tanya's aunt's home in Tehachapi, New Mexico. And this was the last time that Tanya was seen. Tanya's family says that Jason Thornburg was abusive towards Tanya in the past. Thornburg was questioned by police, but released, however. What's more is that Tanya's family reported her missing to three different agencies in at least three different towns, Gallup, Tehachapi, and Leop, all with little support. I will note here that 84% of Native American women will experience violence. 56 report experiencing sexual violence. An astonishing 96% of violence against Native women is committed by non-Native men. This is due in part to a 1978 Supreme Court ruling Oliphant versus the Suquamish Indian tribe that ruled that tribes cannot arrest or prosecute non-Native people who commit crimes on Native lands. Only federal agencies can prosecute individuals for crimes. In 2016 alone, federal prosecutors declined to prosecute 46% of all Indian country cases. So almost half of all cases taking place against Native Americans were dropped by federal prosecutors. A former North Dakota Senator, Heidi Heitkamp, described these as jurisdictional black holes that essentially create an open season on Native American women in which non-Native men are hunters and Native women are the hunted. The last story I want to tell you is that of Jermaine Charlo. 23-year-old Jermaine went missing from Missoula, Montana on June 16, 2018. Jermaine went out on June 15th and was seen on surveillance video leaving the Badlander bar around midnight. Other reports state that she was dropped off on 5th Street between Russell and Orange Streets and was seen walking toward the Orange Street food farm. This was the last time that anyone saw Jermaine. Her aunt knew something was wrong when her social media accounts went inactive. As a 23-year-old young woman, it was unlike Jermaine that she was not posting on social media. Her aunt was also unable to reach her by phone. Missoula Police Detective Guy Baker of Life PD fame has spent countless hours on Jermaine's case. If you watch Life PD, you'll see Guy Baker. Life PD is on A&E, I believe. You'll see Guy Baker on there. My sister got me watching Life PD this last summer. He has spent countless hours on Jermaine's case, and he's also been working closely with the Flathead Indian Reservation Tribal Police, and he points out that a lot of people have a hard time talking to a non-Native law enforcement officer on tribal land, so that building that trust between two agencies is essential. The Flathead Indian Reservation is sort of ahead of the game. They're the only reservation in Montana covered by Public Law 280 that allows tribal police to share jurisdiction with local police, and that allows them to work together rather than relying on the FBI or the Bureau of Indian Affairs to investigate crimes. They are also able to build trust among the community by working together on outreach events and working together on building strong communication between the two agencies. The Flathead Indian Reservation Tribal Council was also critical in providing a conference for law enforcement that established protocols for when someone goes missing and coordinating efforts for law enforcement to train tribally owned casino and resort employees to spot signs of sex trafficking. Another issue is the lack of mental health services, drug and alcohol addiction linked to poverty and violence. A New York Times article from December also outlines the crisis unfolding when the missing are found, and sometimes the missing person is found but in a severe mental health crisis or coping with addictions. They are often found homeless and with criminal charges against them. Many of the missing are adults, so the law says they're allowed to be missing, so no one has to inform the family if the person is in jail, in a homeless shelter, or in a hospital. According to the FBI, Native Americans go missing at twice the rate of white Americans, and a 2008 Department of Justice report showed that Native women are murdered at 10 times the national average. There are many reasons for this, stemming from institutional and structural racism that leads to high incidence of domestic violence and sexual assault among Native American women. There's also a lack of safety for sex workers. As I said earlier, Alyssa had been arrested for past prostitution offenses. Arresting sex workers does not prevent prostitution. It simply further hinders these women. There are also gaps with the law enforcement, particularly in communicating with tribal leaders and families of the missing or victims of sexual abuse or violence. There's a lack of prosecution for the offenses against Native women, as we said, and there's simply a lack of data regarding the crimes against Native American women. This is something that they're working on. They're working on creating a sort of a national database to start tracking this, to collect this data. But without this data, it leads to misinformation, failure to prosecute, and failure to educate people. These are just a handful of the hundreds of cases I could tell you about, and I just tried to highlight that this issue has been happening for decades, and it happens to women of all ages. I'm going to post all the law enforcement contact numbers along with the show notes for this episode, so if you have any information about any of these cases, please contact the officials related to them. I hope that this episode shed some light on this issue for you. It's not just the United States, that Canada also faces a similar issue. I think bringing awareness to the issue is really important, educating people about this issue. So I hope that you learned something from this episode, and thanks for listening. Bye.